verse 7. Revelation 18:7. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to that same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I reign as a queen, and I am not a widow and will never see mourning. You've got the correlated pronoun here, adjective, hasas, which means generally as much as or as many as. They've translated it here, to the degree. She has glorified herself is doxazo, the verb to bring glory, D-O-X-A-Z-O. This is self-glorification, which obviously is offensive to God. This is a manifestation of pride. And this is the chief sin of the universe, of course. It was the first one Satan committed. To the degree that she glorified herself, accused the feminine of autos, and lived sensuously. Again, the verb here, straniao, S-T-R-E-N-I-A-O-O, or I-A-O, there's only one O, sorry. Straniao, two times it means to live sensuously, luxuriantly, wantonly, to revel or indulge oneself. Again, the from what I can tell, the gist of this word, it's not used much in or out of the Bible, in fact. And it has the idea not of sensual in terms of sex, but sensual in terms of luxury, to pamper oneself. To that same degree, as you have an adjective here, the accusative masculine singular of tosoutos, T-O-S-O-U-T-O-S, as much as large as, again, to the degree or to the extent, to that same degree, give her, didymi is the verb, give her torment, basanismos. Again, this word, B-A-S-A-N-I-S-M-O-S, basanismos. Six times, it's only in Revelation. It's used of temporal torment in, say, 9:5. And eternal torment in 14:11. So, which is in view here is going to be the temporal aspect, as we might imagine. And the word originally meant to stretch one out on a rack to interrogate them. So it came to have the idea of to rack somebody with pain is the idea of it. So torment is a good translation from it. Give her torment and penthos, mourning. P-E-N-T-H-O-S. Five times, this is an outward expression of grief, lamentation. Because, conjunction haughty here introduces an explanation, because in her heart, she says, in the heart is preposition in plus the locative of cardia. The heart here is obviously not her literal heart. It's figurative. For the innermost man, and the reality is the heart represents, again, the current you. You can have a change of heart. It means you've fundamentally revamped a Norman standard. Here, the heart is, again, fundamental to the person. And we're dealing with an entity, so obviously it's not the literal heart, because we're dealing with a nation. Give her torment and mourning, for she says, present indicative of lego, keeps on saying, that should say says, not lays, it's... she keeps on saying, and then haughty here functions in a different sense. It introduces indirect discourse, and it gives the content of what she says in her heart. She sits on her heart. She says in her heart, I sit. Kathemai is the verb, and that means first to sit, K-A-T-H-E-M-A-I. But I sit as a queen, and so the idea here is I reign, to sit on a throne as a queen. I reign a queen. Basilisa, this is an interesting form because it's a feminine, B-A-S-I-L-I-S-S-A. Basileus is a king, Basilisa is a king, a queen. I sit as a queen, and a widow I am not. Widow is Kheros, C-H-E-R-O-S. This poses a question, who does she claim is her husband? And the idea is a widow in the ancient world was a symbol of weakness. It was, these people were preyed upon because they didn't have money and they didn't have the power and they oftentimes could not get legal representation. And so the idea of a widow would be the worst form of weakness one might imagine. And she says, and again, this is a part of her boast. And in essence, I'm not a widow, I'm strong. I am not as negative ooh plus the to be verb I me. And mourning, I will never see mourning. And as Chi, penthos, again, you've got that word. Then you've got the negative, double negative, ooh me, which in English, a double negative is bad grammar. In Greek, a double negative is used for emphasis, and you translate it, I absolutely will never see mourning. And then see is the verb eidon here, not in the sense of physical sight, but to it has the nuance of to experience it. I will never experience this kind of mourning. Okay, exposition of these two verses. One, as we have seen repeatedly in this book, this section is dominated once again by the law of lex talionis. Equal and direct retribution. Whenever you get into the language, the grammar of paybacks, that's what you're looking at, is retribution. And throughout this book, God is now making things right that he has allowed under grace for years and years and years to continue. Two, the Lord now turns from addressing his people to addressing those that will be responsible to see that judgment is executed on Babylon. Three, this has created a difficulty for some who are unable to identify the group being addressed in these two verses. Interpreters fall all over themselves here because they don't have, and again, as I pointed out, even though this has tremendous references to these five Old Testament chapters, they don't get it. They, for whatever reason, negative volition of some form, intellectual dishonesty, I don't know, they don't get that these are intimately connected with these five chapters and back in the three in Isaiah and the two in Jeremiah. Even though, again, a good chain reference Bible would direct you back to these passages because these quotes are coming right out of there. So what their problem is they cannot identify the Medes. They can't, well, and again, the bigger problem is they haven't really effectively identified Babylon, frankly. So four, it is clear that the Lord is the ultimate source of her judgment. That is in verse 8. For the Lord God who judges her is strong. But it is clear from verse 6 that he commands the actual execution of judgment to be carried out by an unspecified group. Five, the plural of the verb apodidomi, to reward or repay. And I didn't point that out when I did the exegesis for you, but it is a second person, a person plural. There are multiple subjects in view. Indicates that more than one person is involved in this act of divine retribution. Six, while that group is not specified in Revelation, the Old Testament passages concerning economic Babylon make it plain that the executioners are comprised of a group headed by the prophetic Medes. Seven, as we have previously stated, historic Babylon was destroyed by the literal Medes, who came from the east and southeast, which effectively eliminates them from consideration. If you do a study of the ancient cultures, the Medo-Persian Empire was east and southeast of Babylon. The prophetic Medes, as we'll see, verse 8 here, point 8, prophetic Babylon is to be destroyed by a confederation of nations that attack her from the north. Isaiah 13, 4 and 5. So we're dealing with a different situation. Certainly, the geography is very different, which is one of the tips. But again, when you go back and you study these things, you have to say, well, wait a second. This was not true of historic Babylon, even though these passages address Babylon. So who are they addressing? Chapter 13, verse 4 and 5, a sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people. And we've got in verse 3, I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of the armies is mustering the army for battle. They are coming from a far horizon, a far country. From the farthest horizon, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. And also verse 17 of this same chapter, behold, I am going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. Also Jeremiah 50, verses 3, 9, and 41. And again, you have to put all these verses together, because if you isolate on one of them, you know, it says there, I'm mustering the nations for battle. Now, verse 3 says, a nation has come up against her out of the north. Well, it's a nation, apparently, that commands a lot of little satellite nations. There is a major player in this, clearly. But it is also a confederation in some ways. And so, as the Soviet Union broke up, at one time it was all considered just one big entity. Now it no longer is. You have all those stands over there that are byproducts of the breakup of the Soviet Union. Although, the fact is, the Soviets still control and have a lot of control over these little satellite nations. And all the weapons in these little satellite nations that were there are still there. It's not as though the Soviet government just went and got all of them. They left them there. And the question becomes at some point, of course, one of the questions was during these upheavals and all, is who's in charge? Who's got their fingers on the button over there? So a nation has come up against her out of the north. It will make her land an object of horror, and there will be no inhabitant in it. Both man and beast have wandered off. They have gone away. Verse 9, for behold, I am going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations from the land of the north. And they will draw their battle lines against her from there. See, they're going to take Babylon this is another little tip here. They take Babylon without ever leaving their land. Now, you can't do that in conventional warfare. And Babylon was not captured historically by the Medes remaining in Medo-Persia. They came to Babylon to take it. And so you've got this other little tip here that this destruction comes from that place, and they never leave their land. And obviously, once you figure out all the details and the clues, clearly you wouldn't want to leave your land. You don't want to go over there to that nuclear desert. And also verse 41, behold, a people is coming from the north and a great nation, and many kings will be aroused from the remote parts of the north. And then 51, verses 27 and 28. Lift up a signal in the land. Blow a trumpet among the nations. Consecrate the nations against her. Summon against her the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz. Appoint a marshal against her. Bring up the horses like bristly locusts. Consecrate the nations against her, the kings of the Medes, their governors and all their prefects, and every land of their dominion. So, 9, the verb apodidomi is used twice in the first clause of verse 6 to indicate that God's retribution in this matter is based on her previous activities. Jeremiah 50:15. Raise your battle cry against her on every side, for she has given her hand. Her pillars have fallen. Her walls have been torn down, for this is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance on her. As she has done to others, so do to her. And verse 29, also that same chapter, summon many against Babylon, all those who bend the bow. Encamp against her on every side. Let there be no escape. Repay her according to her work, according to all that she has done, due to her. For she has become arrogant against the Lord, against the Holy One of Israel. 10, there is no discrete object for the second use of the verb, suggesting that it is to be taken in a general sense with many possible objects. When you look at the grammar of the Greek, pay back even as she has paid. And it doesn't say who she paid to. But the reality is that there are multiple objects here. 11, the sense of the phrase is pay her back according to the same standard that she has used to pay others back. 12, there is certainly an undercurrent of implied treachery, although not explicitly stated, which we find a very real characteristic of prophetic Babylon. Isaiah 21:2. And this is probably a verse that sums up as much as anything the current state of affairs. A harsh vision has been shown to me. The treacherous one still deals treacherously, and the destroyer still destroys. Go up, O Elam, lay siege Medea. I have made an end to all the groaning she has caused. And if you get into a serious study, and it would be oppressive, but if you're inclined to do it, you can. If you get into a serious study of the effects that we have had around the globe on nations, and the suffering that has come strictly as a result of our policies and what we have done. It's not a pretty picture. It's not a and again, I say we, not us, our leadership and our invisible leadership. Because they have an agenda, and they have the power, and they've pulled it off pretty much. I mean, they've been successful at what they've attempted to do. They have undermined the U.S. Constitution successfully, so, through the court system. They have undermined the free enterprise system. They got us on a central bank, which our founding fathers warned us repeatedly to avoid. Don't put the power in, don't put the money in the hands of the bankers. And one of the things that all bankers have known for a long time, this goes back to the Rothschilds and the wars in Europe and all of that, that it is big money to finance both sides of a war. Because guess what? Military expenses are, you know, they've got to constantly retool. And if you finance both sides of the war, you make money and it doesn't matter who wins. And now that's a convenient little deal. And so everything that we basically, in a sense, that this nation was founded upon, the principles. And not everyone, obviously, in the founding fathers were believers or even claimed to be. But the reality was this was primarily to be an experiment in a Christian nation. And it has ceased to become that. And we see that all the things that have changed in culture and society. And it's not all just a matter of technology. We see the things that have changed in the viewpoints of people. And this nation is not at all what it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I mean, it's not at all. The thinking is completely different now. And we have embraced all the wrong things and thrown out all the right things. I say we, again, not us, but our nation. So the treacherous one still deals treacherously. Keep after it. 13, a cursory study of the manner in which the United States has dealt with its friends and allies will demonstrate that our government has had a propensity for treacherous double dealing. 14, history reveals that our government has publicly spoken against Marxism, communism in the 20th century, but has consistently allowed communist expansion in all areas of the world. 15, beyond that, we have engaged in covert support of regimes in various parts of the world, often arming them with American technology and weaponry. 16, in his book, National Suicide, Military Aid to the Soviet Union, Anthony Sutton documents the transfer of American money and technology, follows a path that eventually leads to Soviet weapons being used against us and our allies. But who finances all this? The bankers. This is where the money comes from for this. And the bankers in our country have knowingly and willingly aided Soviet expansion throughout the world. Why? Because there's big money in it. And again, if you present people with the illusion of a choice, as long as they think they've got a choice, they're happy. And the two-party system's an illusion of a choice. The Soviet, you know, freedom against communists, it's the illusion of a choice. The bankers are arming both sides. They don't care. It doesn't matter to them. And our government has followed the path that the bankers have trodden. Unfortunately, sad but true. 17, he asserts that there are four logical steps in trade between the U.S. and the Soviet Union that eventually leads to Soviet global expansion. A, trade between the U.S. and USSR with an emphasis on technology. B, the subsequent buildup of the Soviet military-industrial complex. C, use of the U.S.-subsidized Soviet military-industrial complex to provide inputs for the Soviet armaments production. And then D, use of those armaments against the United States and its allies. 18, in 1955, the staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary performed a study of nearly 3,000 treaties and agreements, which the Soviets had entered into with the United States and other countries all over the world. 19, in conclusion, they stated that in the short 38 years since the Soviet Union came into existence, the government has broken its word to virtually every country to which it ever signed a promise. It signed treaties of non-aggression with neighboring states and then absorbed those states. So what does this tell us? Our government has funded a study that tells us that we can't trust the Soviets. And yet we continue to play with them. Now, do you want to really hang around somebody all the time you can't trust? And not only that, we don't play with them. We give them money and weapons.
And this is the irony, of course, when they destroy us, it is so deserved. It is so deserved. Because the reality is, we've armed this monster. And we've subsidized this monster. And American tax dollars have done this. American tax dollars financed the production of Soviet armaments that were used to kill our kids in Vietnam. Now, if that's not sick, I don't know what sick is. That's about as sick as you can get. And so and that's just one example. It happened in Korea. It's happened in Vietnam. It's happened in Afghanistan. We went over there and we armed those people that were, we armed the Soviets and then we armed the people that are fighting them. What? Which side are we on? We're not on any side. That's the whole point. It's all about us. 20, although the government of the U.S. recognizes that the Soviets will not keep their word in any foreign agreement and that their intent is aggressive, with world conquest as the ultimate goal, we have continued to infuse this monster with money and technology. And as Khrushchev said, and nobody's ever rescinded this, we will bury you. And they meant it. And they still mean it. Whether, you know, oh, Russia's no longer a threat. We'll see. We'll see if Russia's a threat. 21, most analysts recognize that the continuing crisis in the Middle East has been directly dependent upon the supply of Soviet arms to militant Arab countries and guerrillas. 22, the American casualty toll in the Korean conflict, it was not a war, amounted to some 35,000 killed by an army that was heavily subsidized by the Soviet Union. 23, and see, I told you some of this is going to get oppressive, but, and this is just a, I mean, this, I'm just scratching the surface of the things they've done. You're not getting the whole picture, but this certainly is indicative. Between 61 and 64, American casualties in Vietnam amounted to less than 300 killed and less than 1,000 wounded. However, in 65, the Soviets stepped up the flow of supplies to North Vietnam, and President Johnson stepped up the flow of technology to the Soviets. He was a good guy, wasn't he? We haven't had a good guy. We wouldn't know a good guy. Of course, if it was a good guy, our people in America, we wouldn't elect him. If somebody really stood on a platform of what we ought to be doing, they'd never get elected. They'd be assassinated. 24, in the 4 years that followed, the American toll mounted quite rapidly, with over 30,000 killed and nearly 100,000 wounded. Now, is there any connection here? Or am I the only one that sees it? Johnson steps up the flow of technology and money to him, and suddenly more and more Americans are being killed. Huh. Could the Soviets have had anything to do with it? Of course they did. They financed the army over there. They armed them with the supplies and the technology that we sent them. Now that is sick. The treachery behind all of this is just, and to let your own children go over there and die when you haven't even declared war on these people. And if you go back and you do the research, what was it again that North Vietnam did to us? What was it again that caught us into this conflict? Politicians. They weren't aggressive toward us at all. So 25, apart from exporting American technology to a nation that has demonstrated it is morally and spiritually bankrupt, our leaders have betrayed those they claim to support, including nationalist China, Iran, Turkey, the Philippines, Cuba, Central and South American countries. 26, as we have documented, our leadership has had a history of encouraging others to trust us, whom our government will betray when it is deemed to be in the best national or corporate interest. And sometimes we betray them simply out of corporate interests, simply because the corporations of America say it's a good deal. Well, guess what? I have to believe that the corporations in America, Standard Oil and such, are kind of enjoying the price of gasoline right now. I got to believe that, and people want to make the Saudis the enemies. Oh, sure, they're making lots of money too. Don't get me wrong. But we've supported an oppressive regime in Saudi Arabia because we don't want to rock the boat over there. But, what would the bankers do if the flow of oil suddenly stopped? Well, that would make a, obviously it's not going to happen, but they're not going to let it happen. They couldn't let it happen. So 27, on the domestic front, the U.S. Department of State has acknowledged that our government's inability and unwillingness to abide by its treaty obligations with the Indian tribes has resulted in most Indian treaties being broken. there is a site there. And we're treacherous abroad, and we're treacherous at home. And I understand that the American Indians were basically a bunch of idol-worshipping pagans, and God jammed them. I'm aware of that. I'm not naive with respect to this. But the fact is, we still haven't kept our word. That's really what it boils down to. Our nation doesn't keep its word any better than the Soviets does. And we wonder why God might want to jam us. 28, the sad reality is that our nation has manifested what Wall calls a functional atheism in the realm of issues of national sovereignty as well as in the realm of economics, opting for a course of godless pragmatism. It's really just a matter of what's best for the bankers. And pragmatically, that's just the way the nation's going to function. What's best in terms of money? That's the bottom line in this country, unfortunately. And you'll hear that phrase used all the time. Well, that's you know what the bottom line is. The bottom line's what matters. Net profits. And we wonder why God might want to jam us with that kind of and that attitude permeates our culture, unfortunately. That's not just a function of the government. That's a function of the people in some ways. 29, the next phrase, give back to her double according to her deeds, further indicts political Babylon as being doubly guilty before the Lord. 30, the command continues to be directed towards those that are to destroy Babylon. They are to double the treachery and deceit that she has employed when dealing with others. 31, while some interpreters see this phrase literally to double the doubles as indicating a full or complete requital for her deeds, the Old Testament clearly advocates the position that some crimes demanded a double payment in return. That there were some crimes that when you committed them, you were judged as doubly guilty. And as we will see, one of the things, there's a verse in one of the prophecies about Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. And I read that, I understand that to mean that God has blessed this nation and that it was an object of divine favor at one time. And then, what would make us doubly guilty? To reject all of that and opt for a course of godless pragmatism and functional atheism and to cast out God from everything we even think about. And we wonder why God might be upset. Well, the more you look at this, the more you get into the realities of it, hopefully you see, well, why would God take a nation out in this fashion? We deserve it. And it's only getting worse. That's the problem. As bad as it is today, it's only getting worse. This is your encouragement for today. It's only getting worse. So 32, in light of the double transgressions of internationalism and economic exploitation, double judgment and retaliation are certainly in order. Again, the law of Lex Talionis governs all this, equal and just retribution. What's fair? And God is always fair. So if God takes a nation out like this, it's got to be right. It's got to be fair. It's got to be just. 34, in fact, the U.S. has enjoyed, 33 rather, this phrase also suggests that if her punishment is to be doubled, then she must have enjoyed double blessing before the Lord, making her all the more culpable. In fact, the U.S. has enjoyed the blessings of peace and prosperity over the course of her history and is referred to as a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. The Jeremiah 51:7 was the verse to which I alluded. And again, clearly a golden vessel, this is viewed as being honorable. It doesn't say Babylon has been a spittoon. I mean, that would conjure up a different image now, wouldn't it? Babylon has been an outhouse. That conjures up something completely different. A golden cup. A vessel that was fit for God, we might even say. And that was, again, the beginning stages of the nation were based on all that. So they've been a cup, but now, unfortunately, we've started intoxicating all the earth. What have we filled the cup with? Well, it's our doctrines. It's our economic policies, our international policies. We've filled it with these lies, basically, and fed it to the nations. And the nations drank up. So, again, you got two things going on here, and you don't want to lose sight of them. Number one, the guilt of Babylon is one thing all in itself. But the nations have willingly complied with all this. It isn't as though people are standing around. Well, there was like 100,000 of them in Iraq chanting, U.S. go home. But, you know, that was in the paper today. Just a small demonstration of how much they like us and how glad they are we're there. They didn't like Saddam, but they don't like us any better. And by the way, let those people work out their own problems. Whatever happened with the idea of remaining aloof from all this as a nation? We were warned repeatedly to avoid entangling alliances. We were told. Our nation knows better. But yet, those old dumb white guys that founded the country didn't know anything. They were all idiots because some of them owned slaves. But guess what? Slavery is a legitimate institution. It still exists. We saw that in Revelation 18 there. Well, we're going to see it. I'm sorry. We haven't seen it yet. But we trade in the lives of slaves all the time. And people say, oh, slavery doesn't exist any longer. Oh, you're so naive. Please. Give me a break. We trade in human souls. We buy and sell children. And guess what? This is all looked at as normal. But it's not. And we condemn whole segments of humanity to death, and we could care less. Doesn't matter to us. And like I said, I was watching that movie about Rwanda, and it's clear that, you know, the nations just stood around. They knew what was going on over there. We weren't stupid. We had intelligence. We knew the slaughter that was going on. And if these people want to slaughter each other, that's their business. But for us to stand around and try to say we're taking the moral high ground, oh, please. We haven't taken the moral high ground in so long, it's not even funny. I don't even know if we know as a nation where the moral high ground is anymore. But, and so we wonder, why would God do all this? Well, we had the blessing. We had the prosperity. We had the ability to do these things, and, you know, we've blown it. 36, the product that has been provided to all the nations is the wine of the passion of her immorality, the drinking of which is designed to emphasize participation in the lifestyle or destiny of the one in view. Ezekiel 23. Verse 32. Thus says the Lord God, you will drink your sister's cup, which is deep and wide. You will be laughed at and held in derision. It contains much. You will be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, the cup of horror and desolation, the cup of your sister Samaria. And you will drink it and drain it, and you will gnaw, and then you will gnaw its fragments and tear your breasts, for I have spoken, declares the Lord. And again, this just is emphasizing that Israel's going to suffer. When it says drink the cup, it means they're going to suffer the same fate of their Samaritan counterparts. And also Mark 10:38 and 39, where Jesus used this figure. 10, when talking about the cup, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? In other words, are you able to endure or to participate in what I'm going to have to do? And at some level, of course, they participated, the disciples did, in suffering, but they didn't participate in the bearing of sins, which is really what he's talking about here, the baptism with which I am about to be baptized. And they shared at some level in the sufferings, as we know later on, but not, they didn't share in the real reality of the bearing of sins. So, again, it's a deal of participating in something. 37, the wine in the figure is that which intoxicates and brings one under its control. When it says, do not be drunk with wine, you could easily translate that, do not be under the control of alcohol, to the point where alcohol is controlling you. It's not a verse against don't drink. It's a verse against don't get drunk. Do not be drunk under the control of alcohol. But be filled, and again, you could translate that, be under the control of the Holy Spirit. That the two are opposite. So 38, America, again, this wine, this points to the specific doctrines, 37, with which we have intentionally influenced the nations of the world. 38, America has become the leader and promoter of a world controlled by money, technology, and corporate politics, which are endorsed and promoted by our government and many massive corporations greedy for profit. And the reality is, you know, guess what? We know some of these drugs might kill you, but, if you know, what happens if Pfizer goes out of business? Who's going to support the golf tournament? Well, we can't have that. We know that these drug companies make exorbitant profits and that they could sell you the same drugs for half the price or less. But our government makes sure that the status quo is never damaged. It's never changed. So, you know, if you wanted to buy your medication from somewhere else, you're not allowed to. You're a criminal now. Oh. How did our government get in the bed with the drug companies? Moolah. Political action committees. All these things that they do to influence government so that the government makes laws that are convenient for them. And, hey, we know that, you know, we should be able to have health care in America, but, hey, guess what? I think I just read something the other day. Health care costs or premiums are up something like 60%. Well, how long can people endure double-digit inflation when wages are going up at about the rate of 3%? You can't. Eventually, there comes a point where the system's going to break. That's another reason why I think we've got to be pretty close to the end of this deal. We are living in such a house of cards that a good strong wind's going to blow the whole thing over. We're printing dollar bills that aren't worth anything, and we've got the world convinced that they're worth something, but they're not. They're not worth anything. Money is an illusion. But guess what? It's what makes the world go around, or certainly is in some ways. So we're going to outlaw the drugs that you like to do, but we're going to sell you drugs that'll kill you. We're your friends. We're here to help. Are you kidding me? And then, you know, and then I was reading this article, and then this guy's running around trying to get up all the drugs he can before they pull them off the market. Well, don't you think they're dangerous? Why would you be laying them up? So, but we're a society with tons and tons of health problems, but all the drugs in the world aren't going to solve our health problems. When basically, you know, some good common sense things would help us work 40 hours a week, exercise, eat right, get enough sleep. You do those four things and you may not need a lot of drugs. So, I'm not just picking on the drug companies. They're just one of them. They're just one of the corporations our government serves. The oil companies are another one. The lawyers are another one. We can't advertise a legal product like vodka on television, but I can sit there and listen to 40 ambulance chasers come and tell me how I need to sue the nursing home. And I hear that commercial all the time. What is wrong with our culture? We've outlawed that. You know, we've turned. I'm not for smoking, and I don't think smoking's healthy. But if you want to smoke, that's your business. It is a legal product. Last time I checked, and we've criminalized it. We've demonized and vilified everybody that has anything to do with tobacco. Hey, some people like smoking. I like a good cigar now and again. But you know what? I can't get Cuban cigars. Why? Because we're keeping the world safe. Now, how is me smoking a Cuban cigar affecting the world? Could somebody explain that to me? Wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense. We need to step back and realize none of this it doesn't make any sense. If the glove don't fit, you must have quit. Well, that don't make no sense. Well, guess what? You don't have to make sense to be a hero nowadays. And somebody pointed out on break there, yeah, we saw them all clamoring around the great whore, didn't we? This week, let's go over there and bow down to the whore, the great prostitute. Oh, he was a good man. Yeah, he was a good man, all right. He just happened to head up a really evil organization. But he was a good guy. Well, 39, our government has historically engaged in international meddling, bringing the promise of democracy and capitalism to the backward nations that did not understand their altruistic, that's a word that means devotion to the best interests of others, intentions, while actually promoting the agenda of world government. And 40, the wine of our immorality then refers to the things the globalists offer to the nations in order to intoxicate them and cause them to buy the doctrines, which promise much to them and simply benefit the globalists. Who's getting rich off of all of this? There's a lot of money being made. Who's getting it? It's not me. I'm not getting rich off of it. So we're going to have to stop there because this is the month that we observe the Lord's table. So we'll get all that in order and in place. We will observe that ritual.